Good morning, everyone, and welcome to CSIS. We're delighted to have such a large crowd this morning. I think that that's an indicator of the importance of the issue we're going to talk about today. I'm Johanna Nesseth. I'm Vice President for Strategic Planning here at CSIS. And on behalf of John Hamry and our board, we're really delighted to welcome Josette Sheeran, who is the head of the World Food Program, as you all know. The Smart Power Speaker Series, which this session is a part of, is an outgrowth of the CSIS Commission on Smart Power, which was co-chaired by former Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage and Harvard Professor Joe Nye, who are both on our board. This commission grew out of a need to really recast a more optimistic future for U.S. foreign policy. And as we looked at some of the options for recasting a more optimistic future for foreign policy, food aid and development assistance were one of the major recommendations that came out of this report, which was released in November. Now, the speaker series, this is the 19th installment. We have had a range of people talking about how the U.S. can improve its image abroad and different ways of using smart power. We've had everyone from generals from the military, foundation presidents, CEOs, and ambassadors share their insights on how the U.S. can balance and integrate its soft and hard power. And we think today is especially important. As you no doubt know, there has been an explosion of media attention to the problems with the food supply and food prices around the world. And Josette, who is head of the World Food Program, is going to talk about her experience over the past year and where she sees food assistance and food security going. Now, Josette joined WFP about a year ago from her post as Undersecretary of State for Economic, Business, and Agricultural Affairs. And prior to her appointment there, she served as Deputy USTR and was also managing editor of the Washington Times. Now, as you've probably seen in the media, Josette has really been out in front on all of the food supply and food pricing issues. She's been warning about a perfect storm of challenges that was shaping up around a confluence of global trends, including soaring food and energy crisis, spiking demands from India and China for commodities, and an increasingly extreme weather cycle, as well as population growth and the impact of HIV and AIDS and other public health issues. And WFP and other actors in the humanitarian arena are facing a crisis at the global level at an unprecedented level of scope and severity, with implications far greater than we would have imagined and far greater than the regions in which they're happening. Now, as we have planned for this event, we've worked closely with WFP, with Mike Uznick and Jen Parmley, and appreciate their assistance as well as with CARE, and have been talking about the fact that while there are a lot of efforts on food security, there's a lot of understanding of food aid, we really are looking at a whole new dimension of food instability and a whole new realm of issues. And we're looking at starting a working group to look at the high-level changes around this area, including changes in supply driven by demand for ethanol and commodity prices, changes in demand driven by diets in mega countries like China and India, as well as conflicts and public health trends, as well as some options for strengthening U.S. policy approaches. And Josette is dealing with all of those and really sits at the intersection of all of those areas. So with that, please join us at the podium, and we're just really looking forward to your comments. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank CSIS and President Hamry, Arnold Borgroth, Steve Morrison, and you, Johanna, for really an excellent reception here in Washington. We've had an opportunity to work with the CSIS team on a wonderful and very fruitful partnership to raise critical humanitarian issues before the U.S. policy community. And I want to thank you and all your work with the Smart Power Commission and the excellent recommendations there. This meeting comes at a critical time when food and food prices are daily headline news. News reports and images from Haiti of deadly riots triggering the collapse of the government are stark reminders that food insecurity threatens not only the hungry, but peace and stability itself. Yesterday, South Africa joined 33 other nations that have seen thousands of hungry people pour onto the streets demanding relief. And as I talk with farmers and consumers in the developing world, they express confusion and frustration as to what is robbing them of their milk, their weekly portion of meat, or for those making less than 50 cents a day, reducing them to a single bowl of rice or grain or a single piece of bread a day. With little awareness of the macroeconomic forces at play, many blame their own leaders and local suppliers, millers, traders, anyone, threatening confidence in fragile democracies and markets. The world's misery index is rising, and as soaring food and fuel prices roll through the lives of the most vulnerable, a silent tsunami that respects no borders. Most don't know what hit them. With the price of rice rising 75% in just the past 2 months, and wheat rising by 120% over the year, the world's most vulnerable are getting hit hard. The issue here is resiliency. And for the 160 million people living on less than 50 cents a day, there is no place to retreat. There is a new face of hunger, with people who were not in the urgent category just a few months ago joining the ranks of desperation. Amartya Sen's groundbreaking work studying the root causes of famines found they are at their root caused by the disparity of food prices, which rise rapidly during a disaster, while family income declines and traditional coping methods become exhausted. The World Bank estimates that these rapidly accelerating prices will drive 100 million people into even more extreme poverty and places 33 nations at risk of instability due to soaring prices. Joachim von Braun, the Director General of the International Food Policy Research Institute, warns that developing nations, especially net food importers, are being hit hardest. He says, quote, "The world food system is in trouble, and the hot spots of food risks will be where high food prices combine with shocks from weather or political crises. These are recipes for disaster." United States Agricultural Secretary Ed Schaefer said this week that the world has never been, quote, "less secure about the near-term future of wheat as crop failures and disease combine to threaten food supply. U.S. wheat stocks are at 60-year lows." The Secretary General of the United Nations has declared a global food emergency, and the head of the World Bank has called for a new deal on global food policy. The President of El Salvador has called this a perfect storm, and the Prime Minister of India has said this will threaten India's economic growth and poverty reduction. And Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said yesterday, quote, "This is a current emergency, but has long-term global challenges. Those who are hardest hit are the poorest people. And of course, this is a matter of social justice, because no one should have to spend all their daily wages to buy bread." This week, the President of the United States released 200 million in emergency food stocks to meet the urgent call of hunger, and Congress is considering an emergency supplemental to meet these burgeoning needs. This continues America's noble tradition of providing half of all emergency food assistance to those trapped in abject hunger. America, some decades ago, through science, technology, hard work, and the vision of people like Norman Borlaug, unlocked the keys to food abundance. After World War II, America also decided to reach out, regardless of friend or enemy, with life-saving food to a war-torn world, building a generation-long foundation of goodwill and stability. I'll show some slides as I speak, reminding us that the face of hunger is not limited to one generation, one people, one religion, or one nation. As President Kennedy said in launching Food for Peace, quote, "Food is strength, food is peace, food is freedom, food is a helping hand to the people around the world whose goodwill and friendship we want." Today, I would like to talk about three subjects: one, the revolution in food aid; two, the new face of hunger; and three, a global call to action. First, the World Food Program has been undergoing a transformation in how it does business. This is not your grandmother's food aid. The World Food Program is the world's largest humanitarian organization and charged with the responsibility to meet the call of hunger when all other systems collapse. Today, we reach up to 90 million people a year threatened with starvation or acute malnutrition. We are also among the most efficient organizations in the world, using only 7% of our budget on overhead. WFP is 100% voluntarily funded, receiving no assessed funds from any source. When WFP was founded, it literally was a surplus food program, with the nations of the world sharing their bounty with the world's hungry. This saved many millions of lives, but also could be a rather blunt instrument, leading at times to a mismatch between populations and food products, and could lead to disruptions in local agricultural markets. Today, less than 2% of our food are surplus donations. WFP has evolved, and in June, I will present to our board a new strategic plan marking a historic transition from what I call a food aid agency to a food assistance agency. And what I mean by that is looking at how we can use food and food assistance to break the cycle of hunger at its roots to help be part of the long-term solution. We have looked at what I call the value chain of hunger to ensure our interventions are coherent with the work of governments and our UN partners, from UNDP to OCHA to UNHCR, UNICEF, WHO, and our vital NGO partners. I see World Vision here today, CARE, Good Samaritan, Red Cross, Red Crescent, and others. For example, today half of WFP's budget is cash, and we use 80% of that cash to purchase food from small farmers in 69 developing nations, creating win-win solutions to hunger and malnutrition. I think we have some charts available that list all the countries we buy and how much we buy in local purchase. I'll just give you a quick example from Senegal. In Senegal, they have a huge problem with goiter because virtually none of the salt for local consumption is iodized. They have big salt-producing companies that do iodize, but all of it gets exported. So WFP decided that we would purchase our salt for our programs in Senegal from 7,000 village salt producers. Working with the Micronutrient Initiative, we helped them get credit for the equipment and training and the technology to iodize salt. Now today, those 7,000 women have a steady income, and they provide 100% of our salt for our Senegal program. And now they iodize all their salt, which goes on the local market, which is helping address what President Wade called one of the biggest health challenges that Senegal faces. It is really a win-win solution. The salt ladies of Senegal are so good that we are now able to buy much of our salt for our regional program from them. This kind of solution can use food assistance to break the cycle of hunger at its root. These solutions require a team effort, all of us pulling together, not only the Rome agencies, but throughout the global system, governments, NGOs, villagers working together. There are hundreds of such examples. Today, in our school feeding program in Ghana, 100% of the food is purchased locally. When floods devastated Mozambique this year, we procured 70% of the food for victims locally. I call this part of my 80-80-80 solution. 80% of WFP's cash for food is spent in the developing world. 80% of our land transportation is procured in the developing world from local contractors. And 80% of my more than 10,000 staff are hired locally. This infuses more than $612 million into local farmer economies, and over $2 billion a year overall into developing world economies. This helps build capacity at the local level for food security infrastructure, food production, and food policy expertise. We are working with partners such as the Gates Foundation and the Howard Buffett Foundation to get even smarter about food aid interventions and local purchase. And if our new strategic plan is approved in June, WFP will broaden this portfolio of responses to abject hunger. We are asking for a toolbox that can be more nuanced in protecting fragile local markets. Responses ranging from commodities when necessary, such as in Darfur, where 70% of the over 3 million people we feed are fed with American help, and there is no food to purchase locally, to local purchase, when often there's no food on the shelves, but there's food in the farms and there's no infrastructure to get them out, such as in DRC, where we tripled our local purchase this year in the middle of war zone, to targeted food vouchers, to food for work and assets, to local capacity building in food security systems and infrastructure. I got to know WFP, which I call the world's best kept secret, although it's getting a little better known in recent months. Just a few years ago, when Kofi Annan asked me to serve on the high-level panel looking at coherence in humanitarian and development work throughout the United Nations. As I spoke to people around the world and traveled to villages, I heard stories of WFP's determination and courage, and I developed a motto for them before I ever met them. Nothing gets between WFP and a hungry child. Today, WFP manages a global lifeline that can reach any corner of the globe in 48 hours, as we did after the war in Lebanon. Thousands of planes, ships, helicopters, barges, and when needed, donkeys, camels, elephants, or whatever it takes. We deliver not only food, but an array of life-saving goods for dozens of partners, including medicines for WHO. And our humanitarian air service brings 400,000 humanitarian and development workers in and out of disaster zones each year. I will just point out that these challenges cost lives. WFP provides the only access to food, as I mentioned, to 3 million people a day in Darfur. Between September and December 2007, 13 of our trucks were ambushed in Darfur, 7 of those drivers are still missing, and 3 were killed. Since January, there were 60 attacks on our trucks in Darfur, 42 are missing, 29 drivers unaccounted for, 1 killed, and 4 killed in southern Sudan. This week, we put out an urgent announcement that due to this violence, we were only able to get half the necessary supplies into Darfur, threatening a 50% cut in rations just as the lean season is arriving. Our ships regularly get attacked by pirates off the coast of southern Somalia, where the lifeline saves 1.2 million lives a day. But despite these challenges, WFP is reforming our capability to do our work even better. We urge the world to stand by the humanitarian workers from the United Nations, AID, European Aid, and all our NGO partners. Let's talk about what I call the new face of hunger. Soon after joining WFP, a year ago, as Johanna mentioned, I looked at our portfolio of work and became very concerned about the trends in global food markets. The cost of food had been steadily increasing, reversing over 4 decades of declining prices. I saw that the world was consuming more than it produced, with food stocks being drawn down to their lowest levels in 3 decades. Reducing the stock-to-use ratio from about 120 days of supply to 1/3 that number. I looked at increasingly severe weather events that were significantly impacting harvest from Australia to West Africa to Bangladesh, with climate change portending even worse. I said at the time we were facing a potential perfect storm for the world's most vulnerable and thought that we had a few years early warning. But then, starting in June, prices started aggressively accelerating, with WFP's average global purchase price for grain rising 55% from June to this February. This pattern of aggressive increases has continued. On March 3rd, WFP was paying $460 for a metric ton of rice in Asia. Today, the cost is $780 a metric ton. I believe we are now in the eye of the storm. If you look at some of the factors driving the storm, most experts predict they'll be with us for some time. A confluence of factors are responsible for aggressively soaring commodity prices. At core, this is a supply and demand challenge. For example, rice consumption has outpaced production for the past few decades, cutting global rice reserves by half since 2000. Food supply is relatively inflexible and vulnerable to unpredictable factors such as weather, and all global stocks have drawn down to the lowest level in decades. I will briefly touch on 5 factors which present the world with both challenges and opportunities. First, the economic boom in some parts of the developing world. This means people in emerging economies, including China, India, Brazil, and more than 10 growth leaders in Africa, are changing their diet, as others have done throughout history as they become more prosperous. China has almost doubled its consumption of meat, fish, and dairy products since 1990. This takes a lot of grain off global markets since, for example, it takes 7 pounds of grain to produce 1 pound of meat. This increased demand in China reached a tipping point over the past few years, with China disappearing as one of the largest grain exporters in the world into an importer of grain virtually overnight. China has one-fourth the global grain reserves, and they have been at an all-time low. The second factor is the price of oil, which, as head of the World Food Program, I look to the oil price every day to determine how much hunger there'll be in the world. It has reached record highs this week at $115 a barrel. This drives up costs across the entire value chain of food production, from fertilizer to diesel, for tilling, for planting and harvesting, to storage and shipping. High oil prices also make food a financially attractive input for industrial use, which leads to the third factor is the global linking of food and fuel markets. As farmers all over the world know, advanced production techniques for biofuels and biodiesel, combined with the high price of oil, make feedstock an increasingly attractive input for industrialized use. This is a global phenomenon affecting markets for wheat, maize, sugar, oilseeds, cassava, palm oil, and beyond. Fourth is increasingly severe weather. According to USAID's Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance, the total disasters worldwide, on average, are now 400 to 500 a year, up from an average of 125 in the early 80s. This has affected WFP. In the 1980s, 80% of our work was developmental, 20% emergency. We've now reversed that rate, with over 80% of our work emergency and less than 20% developmental. Another factor, no doubt, is the dramatic increase in futures markets and hedging on agricultural products, increasing price volatility, and the reactive policies that are creating even tighter supplies by shutting down exports. Today, one-third of the globe's wheat suppliers have banned exports. Before I outline the impact of these developments on WFP a little bit more, I'd like to say that I'm a medium to long-term optimist. At its root, increased demand should be an opportunity. This perfect storm has dramatically raised awareness that food cannot and must not be taken for granted. Food, to the shock of many, does not spontaneously appear on grocery store shelves. That the food supply chain, from inputs to planting, to harvesting, to processing, to storage and delivery, and all the supporting market structures, such as access to credit, risk mitigation, commodity exchanges, crop surveys, water access, are all vital to world stability and prosperity, is something the world is waking up to. And it has also increased awareness that we have to prepare for the challenges of climate change, which the Intergovernmental Panel Report on Climate Change predicts that in some food insecure areas, particularly rain-dependent Africa, could produce half the yields in the next 12 years that they are producing today. But also, this is an opportunity, not only for the American farmer, but hopefully for poor farmers in Africa and elsewhere. 70% of African farmers are women, and she often bears more of the risk and receives less of the gain for her efforts than any farmer in the world. In fact, almost half the world's hungry are marginalized farmers with little or no access to fertilizer, seeds, tractors, credit, markets, or extension services. Perhaps, as I mentioned to African finance ministers last week at the African Union, the time has finally come for the African farmer. Let us take today's global food crisis as an early warning and an incentive to revolutionize agricultural policies and investment and access to the science and technologies that can defeat hunger once and for all. Now on to some of the challenges. In a time of increased need, WFP is able to reach fewer people than ever before. Due solely to soaring prices, today WFP has 40% less food in the pipeline than in June for the same contribution. For our programs, this is a direct impact. I was just in Kenya in the Kibera slums at a school where many of the children rely on WFP for their only cup of food each day. Some of you have seen my red cup before. This is from one of our school feeding programs in Rwanda. But you, if you travel throughout the world, you will see this cup, these cups in schools all over the world, the 20 million children we reach and who many other reach in schools. Today, this cup can get filled 40% less due simply to soaring prices. When I was in Kibera, for many of the children, it's the only cup of food they get a day. That is vulnerability. And we found that many of the kids were taking half the food home for their siblings who had no food at home. Without increased donations, all of WFP's work is threatened with a 40% reduction in coming months. This is why we've put out an emergency appeal to the world, an extraordinary emergency appeal. WFP must raise its core budget of $2.9 billion, and our emergency gap appeal, which I announced in February, was $500 million. Since that announcement, the gap has increased to $755 million. Neither of these numbers includes new needs, which leads to the second point. Right now, we have an emerging new face of hunger, as we've discussed. Many are being driven into greater poverty and malnutrition. This is hitting households hard, and coping strategies are getting stretched thin. For those on $2 a day, we are finding they are giving up education and health care expenditures. At a dollar a day, they're giving up protein and any kind of addition to their diet like vegetables. At 50 cents a day, which includes 160 million people, as I mentioned, there's no place to retreat. So they're already just eating three bowls of grain a day. That's getting reduced down to two or one. Most vulnerable are import-dependent nations, which includes most of Africa and, by the way, most of the world. The vast majority of nations are food importers. And you take an import dependency and add one more shock, like the cyclone in Bangladesh or the floods in West Africa, and we find people being driven to desperation. So in this new face of hunger, we've already clocked in new emergency requests, such as the emergency appeal issued with the government of Afghanistan in January for 2.5 newly hungry people at a cost of $77 million, priced out of the food market. Since January, there's been almost a half a billion in new needs identified. Third, we are concerned about access to food supplies. For the first time in our memory, we tried to buy wheat this fall to make biscuits for the victims of floods in DPRK, and for 10 days, we couldn't buy it anywhere in Asia. In the past few weeks, we have had five of our food contracts broken. Between the time we made the contract and picking up the food 2 weeks later, prices have risen so quickly that they wanted to sell to a higher bidder and willingly paid the 5% performance bond to get out of our contract. The fourth is connected to that. This is a new observation based on my travels to Africa last week. One would expect that the natural reaction from farmers throughout the world to high prices would be to plant more. In the developing world, there are indications the reverse is happening. I knew that poor farmers were not benefiting widely from the high prices because half the hungry in Africa are farmers who can't even produce enough for their own family. Most are so disconnected from markets that they can't really benefit. What I didn't realize and what I saw in Africa is that many are planting less, not more than before, because they can't afford the inputs. So in Kenya, fertilizer has gone from 1,700 shillings in December to 4,000 shillings just 12 weeks later. And I went to the Rift Valley, which is the breadbasket of Kenya, and they were planting one-third of what they were planting a year ago. According to the International Herald Tribune, this is happening in Laos, and IFAD says they are seeing this happening throughout the developing world. These farmers are retreating to subsistence mode, withdrawing from markets until things stabilize. This could indicate serious shortages in upcoming harvests, further compounding the global challenge. The BBC interviewed a reporter from Haiti this week who said, quote, there's no room for error here. Things could go bad really quickly. Desperation's growing quickly. I talked to a member of Congress who said he ran for Congress as a medical doctor because he had come to understand that there's only seven meals between civilization and anarchy, meaning at the seventh meal lost, things fall apart. My fifth concern I will outline here is that many of the policy reactions globally and locally may actually be helping to feed the crisis, not people. It is understandable that nations will use whatever levers they have to alleviate pressure. Yet some of these may deepen the challenge. Today, many of the world's farmers are under price controls, further discouraging increased planting. Inputs rise, but food prices are under a ceiling. A range of major food exporters have closed down exports almost overnight, from China to Vietnam to Argentina to Kazakhstan. This global rash of beggar thy neighbor responses will not provide a solution. So what should be done? We must take this crisis as a global call to action. The first Millennium Development Goal calls for cutting the proportion of hungry by half. I call this MDG the Gateway MDG because there's no way to achieve the other hopes and dreams for humanity unless people have access to adequate nutrition. It is the most basic human right. Without food, one is denied the right to life itself. Today, one in every three children in the developing world is stunted. And according to the landmark series in Lancet, if a child does not get adequate nutrition under 2 years old, he is crippled for life. Hunger can be defeated, and the world knows how to do it. Many countries have made vast progress, including the country of my ancestors, Ireland, in breaking the cycle of hunger at its root. In addition, we must look to the plight of the smallholder farmer and develop medium and long-term supply-side solutions. My hope is that the time has come for the smallholder farmer to see the kind of investment that can break this cycle. So I join with FAO, the World Bank, EFAD, UNDP, and others in calling for a twin-track response to meet the emergency needs, but also step up supply-side solutions. First, we must help governments alleviate immediate suffering and prevent a crippling outbreak of severe malnutrition that could set global development back by decades. When there's no food to be had, we must keep the humanitarian pipeline full. WFP, working with partners such as UNICEF, UNHCR, FAO, WHO, CARE, Save the Children, Good Samaritan, Oxfam, and thousands of local NGOs, have the immediate ability, if needed, to scale up safety net operations such as school feeding, general food distribution, and therapeutic feeding. We have tools now where we can reach under two-year-olds and alleviate an acute malnutrition crisis virtually overnight. We also have great expertise in designing price stabilization programs, safety net programs, such as we're doing in Egypt to help the government with the crisis there, and also vouchers. We're seeing in this new phase of hunger sometimes people who can't afford the food off the shelves. They need help for a targeted short period of time, and we've done some of that in Indonesia after the economic crisis there. We're working with the Gates Foundation and others to look at our local purchase and how we can use our contracts to drive long-term solutions. For example, right now, if we could give forward contracts to farmers, they may be able to get the credit to get the fertilizer to help break the cycle of no planting. We're looking to launch a major program to look at the way we do business and to do it in a way that can really help. This has helped in places like DRC, as I mentioned, which is at war, but we're buying from farmers there completely cut off from markets due to conflicts. We can go in there with our logistical strength and help them get credit in a powerful way. I will assure you that WFP will be a leading voice in encouraging the work of the African Union, regional economic commissions in Latin America and Asia, FAO, and others in long-term solutions. The countries of the African Union through NEPAD have committed to devote 10% of their GDP to agriculture. Today, the average investment is 4%. 10% would add an additional $5 billion to the pot for agricultural development. I was just in Addis talking with the African Union and really see a renewed commitment and energy to get to the root cause of these problems. I also want to commend CSIS for their Smart Power series and their five recommendations. We need to activate all five of them to get at this problem, and so I thank you for the work done there. In closing, I just want to say I can't emphasize the importance of staying the course in this difficult moment. My father, who was in the 101st Airborne Division at D-Day and Bastogne and in Holland, and a hero of mine and many others, always quoted Churchill as saying, quote, "Wars don't make men, they reveal who they are." And so even though I lost him this summer, I think during this hard time that we at WFP want to be revealed as a team that the world can rely on and doesn't blink in this time of challenge. We just completed almost four decades of great gains in tackling world hunger. In fact, we've been able to cut the proportion of hungry in the world in half from 1969 to today, from 37% to 13%. And a number of countries have been on track to reach the Millennium Development Goal on hunger and will by 2015 if we can stay the course. These include Ghana, Chile, Vietnam, Brazil, and others. Many countries are doing the right things. We're seeing a commitment to a green revolution and market revolution led by Gates, Rockefeller Foundation, Jeffrey Sachs, and others. And the World Bank has announced a doubling of financing in agriculture and is launching a new global food policy dialogue. Lastly, there are encouraging economic growth rates across Africa, Latin America, and elsewhere that could help us transform and break this cycle of poverty. Defeating hunger is achievable. It requires no new scientific breakthrough. We know how to do it, and I thank you all for being champions in this battle. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Joseph, for your comments. I know that a lot of you have questions, and we'll have plenty of time for questions, I think. And I'll start with a couple of questions to open things up. You know, polls show that Americans really want to improve the U.S. image abroad, and, you know, food aid and helping to feed poor people around the world is just such a powerful way to do this. But at the same time, we're in an election year where people are very anxious. They're going to the gas pump and paying nearly $4 a gallon for gas. They're seeing their own prices of food increase. Can you talk a little bit about some ways that we can look at long-term solutions to engage the American public, to get them involved in this issue, and really start thinking forward about some, you know, serious shifts in the way we engage the public and on policy matters?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, is that okay? I think, I really do think this wake-up call, this realization of how important agriculture and farming is to the world is critical. America really has been a pace setter in the world in showing how to get increased yields, build in food security. This kind of knowledge is critical. It is really something to see when you go to Africa how little access to any kind of knowledge. How deep should the seeds be planted? Or, you know, much of this is traditional wisdom that's been passed down over generations. Climate change, where the planting cycle has shifted 2 weeks in either direction, is breaking that wisdom and knowledge, and yet there's no follow-on advice to these farmers. I found that farmers around the world, I was just in Kenya and met with some IDP farmers that had been displaced in the violence there, and I went to the IDP camp and sat around with them, and there wasn't a one anxious to get there and touch the soil. They were so frustrated they can't plant, and, you know, these are hardworking people that remind me of the farmers that I meet in Iowa or Kansas. So I'm really hoping that, you know, everything down to the 4-H clubs of the world can really take on the cause of the poor farmer. My ancestors, when the potato blight hit in Ireland, they didn't own their land, they didn't own their inputs, they didn't have any power to change the situation. We're still seeing these same conditions for farmers around the world. So I'm really hoping we can get, you know, a renewed attention on that. But the fact is, when you're hungry and there's no food available, you've got to figure out some way to address that problem, too. So I do think we need this twin track.
I was in 4-H for 10 years, so I like that idea.
Yeah.
Staying on the U.S. front for a minute, your career history has put you really at the intersection of a lot of the issues around food insecurity, trade, and agriculture and energy. I'm wondering if you can offer a few comments about some of the ways U.S. policy can be shaped in these areas that might help improve the situation or mm-hmm. sort of make a long-term investment.
Mm-hmm. Well, the United States has been trying many things that have been extremely helpful, such as the African Growth and Opportunity Act, the whole Green Revolution that helped transform food production in Latin America and Asia over the many decades. But I think for the whole world, agriculture kind of fell off the being the prime attention for a number of years, in part because we were in decades of increasing food abundance and decreasing prices. So I know that Henrietta Fore has spoken about AID kind of refocusing on some of these areas. The World Bank doubling its budget, I think, is a good sign. The U.S. Department of Agriculture does help with standards and technical knowledge on pest control and all of these issues for farmers around the world. I think the U.S. has a huge amount to offer here. And I'm just pleased with, you know, some of my knowledge of that background, that I can bring that to the emergency side so we can play our part in really being a momentum leader in that area. Thank you.
And then moving around the world, just talking about some of the countries that have had dramatic spikes in consumption, China, India, Brazil, what kind of dialogue do you have going with those countries, and how do you start talking with them about the level of consumption and how we work together to, and maybe it's technology, increase yields, mm-hmm. increase production?
Mm-hmm. Well, one big transformation in the world is that if you think about food assistance, we're really seeing a whole new face of food assistance. So Brazil has been one of the first contributors to our emergency call, has contributed to help Haiti. Brazil gave us their first major multilateral contribution this year to help us model best practices in school feeding. I think, for example, the next step in school feeding, which I believe should be a universal phenomenon, Senator George McGovern will not rest until every kid in the world has access to at least a cup of food a day. The World Food Program doesn't have to do this. Mostly governments take this over. But Brazil is helping us think through what's in the cup. We can actually ask that now. It used to be, you know, are kids getting enough calories? Now it's, you know, if we put a drop of vitamin A in there, will that end night blindness? If we put, you know, which micronutrients in there, a cost of 2 cents in addition, can we tackle some of these malnutrition challenges that are faced there? So we're seeing, I do want to mention, many countries contributing, including Malawi when they have a good harvest, helping Swaziland. Zambia was a contributor. The government of Southern Sudan became one of my top 10 contributors last year. Amazing, because they felt our work was so vital to their revival that we're a key partner with them. For the large emerging nations, we are talking to them about being part of the solution. Many of them have solved the plight of the small farmer more recently. China is an interesting example because it's smallholder farmers, or Vietnam, which may be a more apt example for some countries in Africa to learn from. So we've been pulling them into our strategy dialogues about what have you learned, how can we impart that in our work in the developing world.
Great. Well, I know that a lot of you in the audience have questions, so let's open it to some of you. If you will just wait for the microphone and then state your name and affiliation. So right up in the front here. There's a microphone coming behind you.
Ed Berger, the Eurasian Medical Education Program. You mentioned hedging as one of the five factors that were important. Take us a little deeper into the question of what does that mean? How does mm-hmm. that work? And how important is it?
Mm-hmm. I traveled to the Board of Trade in Chicago just to get a sense of what was happening in global ag markets and trade. And the level of activity there has increased, I don't have the exact number, but quite in double digits in recent months, in recent years. We're seeing a lot of investors who understand that agriculture and food is a good investment. But this has changed really some of the traditional patterns of supply and demand, or where futures typically were to help farmers get the credit for planting. And now we're seeing a lot of investment into agriculture. I talked to someone on Wall Street who said they're getting calls saying, I want protein investments. And, you know, so I think part of this is the world waking up to the fact that agriculture is a good investment. That can have good sides, and I think it has helped increase some of the volatility we're seeing. But this isn't mainly my area of expertise. It's really just an observation that I think we're seeing.
Right here in front.
I'm from India Globe in Asia today. I cover the White House, also State Department. I attended this IMF and World Bank meeting, and certainly they were also talking about what you have just said, laid out the foundation. My question is that as far as hunger is concerned, millions of people have been dying in Africa and in many parts of Asia. Certainly now we come to this situation that there is a hunger or food crisis at this time. Is this because of, don't you think there is also culture of corruption in many countries as far as reaching food to the poor and needy, and they stock and then they bring out when there is a high prices. And another thing is that oil prices must be the major factor now. What message do you have for the President of the United States and many world leaders to come up and help those in need, not to fill their own pockets?
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly a whole range of factors can lead to vulnerability of populations. You know, from natural disasters to conflicts to corruption to bad policies, and we see, you know, all of those playing out at different levels and degrees depending on where we are in the world. What I am hoping for is that many of us can make the case to the world that it's not an option to not deal with hunger. And so I think what's happened in recent months is this has just increased the urgency of focusing on the core business of making sure populations have access to food. Sometimes hunger is a forced deprival of food to whole groups of marginalized people. Sometimes it's considered a part of a weapon of conflict. I feel that we're at the point in history where the entire global community say this is not an acceptable tool. If you don't like your neighbor or you don't like a tribe or a clan, whatever, but food cannot be a weapon here, and food cannot be deprived people. And so I do think we're reaching that point. I think global awareness about hunger has created a movement. A student started something on Facebook, and the World Food Program had, for World Food Program, we had like 1.8 million students sign up overnight to that website. There's someone in America wanted to help. He started a website called freerice.com where kids can play a little word game, and if they get the word right and they learn at the same time, 10 drops of rice fall from the sky into a bowl. And he got a number of American companies to agree to buy the rice, and this has now fed over 1 million people in the world. The free rice bags are going around the world. The World Food Program put a competition on YouTube because we can't afford advertising. I told you we only have 7% of our overhead. We have the leanest budget. My entire traveling PR team is my special assistant who's got her doctorate in nutrition from Harvard, but she carries a little flip camera, and we send stuff out to YouTube, you know, from the desert and from wherever we are to get our messages out. So we're lean and we're scrappy, but this competition on YouTube asking kids to submit the best video, 60-second video to raise awareness about hunger, has gotten a flood of responses and wonderful, heart-moving things that will help revolutionize this. I think that now is a moment where we can really try to corral that energy to not only raise awareness, but to provide solutions and to make it just unacceptable for hunger to be a part of the human condition.
Let's look far back.
My name is Gregorio Meraz. I'm a reporter from Televisa News Network from Mexico. And I would like to know, how serious do you believe the situation can get in the world if the countries do not act immediately and provide resources to alleviate the crisis? We have seen that there are some demonstrations of violence in Chile, Honduras, Peru, Ivory Coast, and so many countries. Do you predict this can get worse? Mm-hmm. If something is not done immediately?
We are concerned that there are some underlying factors that could become even more difficult. You know, the problem with food supplies, it's very dependent on weather. But things are very tight right now, so one bad harvest, one bad storm could have a very big effect on these balances. So I think we need an urgent call to action. I think it requires attention at the highest political levels. I think the world needs to pull together and look at how we get through the next few years and how we ensure that there's a long-term response that is securing the global food supply system in a way that even the poorest of the poor have access to affordable food. We know how to do this. This is where I am very confident. This is not going to require a new scientific breakthrough or great levels of research. We know how to do this, which is why, you know, I feel that the real issue here is the political will and the focus and attention that's needed right now. So I think we're seeing that. Secretary General of the UN called an urgency policy committee meeting to look at responses. We're certainly honing in on our recommendations. And, you know, there's a number of opportunities where world leaders will be getting together, and I think it's on everybody's minds now.
Do you agree with theories that believe that the next wars are going to be due to war or food, the lack of war?
Of water and access to basic resources could be the peace and security issue of our time. And, you know, in places like Darfur, if we all achieve the peace that we're hoping for and praying for, we have a challenge because there's more people than the land can support right now. And so we have a reality in many places where, due to climatic changes and shifts, it's going to put a lot of pressure on populations and perhaps, you know, the kind of migration patterns that really make it difficult for people. Again, I think this is moving up on the global agenda to where it needs to be, because we have these short-term challenges, but we also have, you know, many climate challenges coming up that we have to prepare for, which we also have tools to help protect the food supply system. If I could just divert here for 1 minute. WFP, as I said, is one of the world's best-kept secrets, and one of the things I learned when I came on board is that the World Food Program, over the past 30 years, has planted over 5 billion trees in the world. 5 billion trees. And this is because, if you think about the way we do business, we're called in a disaster, whether it's a conflict or a natural disaster. We provide emergency food for people, but before we leave, food systems have to be reestablished. And so often, if there's been a devastating flood, we have to shore back up the riverbeds and the soil. Or after a conflict, all the roads are mined. We have to demine the roads. We're one of the world's biggest deminers. Do you know if you take out a landmine, it's the perfect size for a tree? And we have planted 40,000 trees in Lebanon in former landmine holes, a great symbol of a turn from war to a future. But this kind of work we do is, rather than just hand out food, give people training and help them rebuild their countries, and that allows us to reduce dependency on food. But those trees today, half the trees in Syria were planted by WFP. Pakistan, over a billion trees. Mali, I was just in Timbuktu, 20,000 trees there are protecting rice fields that now flourish so strongly that the biggest problem they had is how to export the rice and could they get a machine for packaging. This is, the sand has taken over everything around there. So these kinds of very practical tools to help the world prepare for changing weather patterns, again, there's a huge amount of expertise. We just need the focus and the will to get it done.
The very back.
I'm with the Afghanistan service from the Voice of America. What you touched upon, the situation in Afghanistan, the need for emergency relief after a very harsh winter. But what is the solution for a country like Afghanistan, which also has years of drought and it has issues of conflict? Is there a different approach? What does this country need?
Well, the World Food Program provides a tremendous amount of help to Afghanistan. One thing that intrigues me about Afghanistan is it's proven it can grow things. It grows a lot. The question is, do farmers get access to the seeds and the markets so that it becomes a viable livelihood? I mean, that's one of the challenges there. So one thing we're doing is working with partners on, I mentioned our work with Gates Foundation and the Buffett Foundation, on a Purchase for Progress pilot there that will look at our wheat needs, growing them locally, by helping farmers get the inputs. Because here's the problem. If you're a farmer in Afghanistan or most places in the world, you decide you're going to grow wheat, where do you get the input? No bank will talk to you. Where do you get the supplies to do so, even if there's a market for it, which there's a huge market in Afghanistan for the wheat? So, you know, it's just in our little piece of the world here. We're going to try to grow as much of the wheat for our program as we can there, which will hopefully give these farmers a contract so they can get the credit, so they can get the, and a guaranteed market, because a lot of people are scared away from markets where there's conflict. So we're there anyway. We're doing these programs. And so we'll look at doing that and hopefully demonstrate, as we did in Laos, by working with former poppy growers there, who now produce, 4,000 farmers produce CSB. It's a fortified blend. They grow the food, and they have a value-added production factory, and they have a lifestyle and a livelihood that is as good, if not better, as before. So, you know, these are small solutions, but they can become models of success. So our little contribution there will be to try to raise some of our food there and provide the kind of security to farmers that can help there.
The sort of middle back of the black shirts.
Lionel Rosenblatt of Refugees International. We've worked over the years with WFP. I have a lot of admiration for your operational capability, your proactiveness. I wanted to get back, particularly with the new face of hunger, to an old issue, which is how to aid vulnerable populations. The old buzzword was relief to development, and I wonder what you have to say about that. Is there an emergency office that looks at that, your liaisons with the UNHCR, and ability to catch people, particularly returnees, who are very vulnerable?
Yeah. This is, before this latest challenge, really was my area of focus. And in the high-level panel I was on at the United Nations, I called this not a gap but a chasm in the global system. We have to get this handshake between disaster and recovery done better. I will give you an example. In southern Sudan, we have everything that we're praying for in Darfur. We have peace. We have a government that wants a unified country that's stable after decades of war. We've only had less than 20% of the returnees come back, because every road virtually was mined and destroyed. But the moment that peace treaty was signed, all the emergency help moves out, and yet it's in such, it's not really ready for the typical capacity building developmental work. So WFP has had hundreds of people there living in tents, and I said, you know, they became one of our biggest contributors, demining roads so farmers can get to market. This kind of basic rebuilding of countries is so critical. And in places like Liberia or Cote d'Ivoire or southern Sudan, if the entire transportation ministry is one person sitting in a cinder block, you know, they don't have the capacity. They need partners to do so. So I think it's there's been tremendous work done by UNDP, the World Bank, and others to try to close that gap. I think, you know, the World Bank, I mean, the WFP can be a very practical helper because we have this huge logistical capability. But we need to do that better. We often see populations slipping back into the same situation. But sometimes we get it right, and when we do, it shows how powerful that can be. One of the great heroes of the impoverished around the world is about to speak here. One of my heroes.
Well, thank you, Gilzette, and thank you for the good work you're doing and the work of the WFP. It really is remarkable. Two questions. The Green Revolution, the first Green Revolution, certainly played a significant role in helping take so many people out of hunger and out of poverty. Is it possible that the long-term solution to this is a second Green Revolution? And I don't even know what elements of that might be. Maybe you might help lead us there in talking about what those elements might be. And that segues into the next question, which are the policies of the United States with regard to agricultural subsidies and the PL 480 prohibitions against local buying and the European prohibitions against genetically modified foods, are they contributing significantly to the problems we have, and can the WFP play a role in helping to shine a light on that and to be a voice for making changes in that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. You know, Norman Borlaug, who was the father, with an excellent team of people and many other great heroes, scientific heroes to the world's hungry, launched the Green Revolution, I think, in Mexico, Latin America first, went to Asia many decades ago. I think he's been credited with saving more human lives than any other person in history. It is true that this contributed when we look at the proportion of hungry that decreased greatly in the world. The Green Revolution has helped throughout the world, dramatically increasing yields. It had some challenges with it in some areas of over-farming or different issues. But now Gates and Rockefeller have pulled together Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, AGRA, under Kofi Annan's leadership, and are looking to launch a similar kind of revolution in Africa. Africa needs specific solutions that are specific to Africa's needs and soil and challenges, but pretty much all the technology is available. It hasn't been aggregated in a powerful way. We are supporting that effort by looking how we can work with the increased yields or special projects on purchasing that food, because part of the problem, I was talking to the president of Tanzania, they had an experience of increasing yields four times, and then there was no delivery system to get the food out. So we'll work with our transportation might and logistic might to try to help with that. And as I said, I'll be a voice helping all these efforts. So I think it is very important. And we do see the seed stock in Africa exhausted. Some of these seeds have been used for over 7 years. They can't refresh them. They need a different variety for it. So those are important. I think macro policy environment's very important. You know, it affects things in different ways. We could do a whole nother session, you know, on these. I know the President of the United States has asked for an ability to use some cash for local purchase. I will just say, you know, we need all the food we can get in the system, and we appreciate it. And I love the connection that really is heartfelt when I meet with farmers throughout America, that they're helping the world's poor. But as you can see from the example in Senegal, farmers also have a heart for farmers. And I would hope that America could be part of this local purchase revolution that we're doing, you know, in any way that America feels it can contribute to that. I think we need the farmers in Africa to overcome this plight. We can't deal with the levels of hunger that could be with us if we don't really find these solutions. And so we are hoping that we can get some support for the local purchase. I think that would be important.
Right back with the brown jackets. Right up here.
Cesar Munoz with FN News Service. I have two questions. One, on the issue of biofuels. I mean, what is your message on that, given, you know, the huge amounts of subsidies that go into that, especially in this country? And then on the issue of the price controls, I mean, looking at the what's happening in Argentina, for example, where the authorities are trying to protect the poor there. I mean, that's why they have the price controls. And also, you know, sort of fight against inflation, which, as you know, is also hurts the poor. So, I mean, what kind of, I mean, they're in a difficult position. What's your message for that government?
Right. Well, I'll take the last one first and then move backwards. As I said, it's really understandable that governments will use whatever levers they have to alleviate pressure. What we're seeing, however, in this kind of rush to alleviate the pressure, that maybe there might be better ways to do this, but this will require a global and regional and local policy dialogue to figure that out. I mean, for example, I was just in Ethiopia and visited an innovative program they have called the Urban Price Stabilization Program, where they're providing subsidized wheat to help make sure families at least have basic grain during this time. And it's you know, just designed for a targeted period of time to alleviate pressures rather than kind of a blanket measure
that could hurt production. Now, I'm not saying that's the answer, but I'm very pleased that the African Union is pulling together a workshop of all the governments in Africa to look at best practices and experiences and urgently share their experiences on how you respond here. And I think it will be important for that kind of policy dialogue to happen. For the World Food Program, that's why we're asking for authority from our board to be able to respond more broadly with vouchers. So, for example, in the situation where, you know, that we may face in West Africa, where the shelves are full, but during the lean season people have run out of money, it doesn't make sense to bring in food as the answer. But maybe a targeted voucher for the lean season to help cut back on that price could be the answer. Now, Mexico and Indonesia have quite a bit of experience after the financial crisis with cash interventions that help alleviate pressure. So we're very quickly pulling together world experts to help us develop a portfolio of responses that can be more nuanced given this new face of hunger. We're all trying to kind of get, you know, fine-tune the policy responses here. On biofuels, you know, this, I think, is an example of what an intertwined world we're in. I mean, you know, farmers around the world are looking for cheaper access to energy. Biofuels can be kind of homegrown at the village level to help alleviate the dependency on needing to bring in fuel supplies. So this is a global phenomenon, because now the technology exists to virtually put anything that can be grown into the hopper and produce fuel. I think part of what has happened is the proliferation of these technologies and the major increase in biofuel production, for example, in the United States, Europe, and elsewhere, has taken place at a time when food stocks are very, very tight. And so it's having, you know, maybe a bigger impact on this challenge than previously. You know, I think most importantly is that the experts sit down and really look at kind of the dynamics of how this all works, rather than, again, reeling about, you know, trying to find solutions without really thinking through how they impact each other. Because access to affordable fuel is critical for the world's hungry also. So I'm really hoping that, you know, the energy experts and others can come together and create a pathway forward that, you know, answers both the food challenge but also the energy challenge.
I think, why don't we bundle a couple of questions since we've got quite a few. Let's take two or three. In the back, the middle, young woman.
Hi, my name is Meredith Slater, and I'm with Friends of the World Food Program, which, just very briefly, for those of you who don't know, is a U.S.-based nonprofit that supports the work of the World Food Program. And my question is, as we all know, the World Food Program is a voluntarily funded agency. So as WFP faces funding shortfalls, how is it determined where programs are cut? More specifically, are they typically in the areas of development, like school feeding? Are they in emergencies? Are they in particular countries or regions?
Next, there's a question, I think, right in front of you. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes. My name's Brenda Wilson. I'm with National Public Radio. And I guess I've heard a lot of talk about hunger and starvation. And what's not quite clear to me as a reporter who focuses on public health, where nutrition fits in there. And I don't know whether we're just simply just trying to deal with an emergency situation there. I don't see very much focus on nutrition in there. An assumption, it seems, that if you give them certain sort of basic food stocks, you've resolved that. And I'm not sure that's clear to me that you have.
One more. Right, Professor.
My name's Herbert Weiss. I'm with the Woodrow Wilson Center. My particular focus is DRC, and the best news I have heard here is that you've tripled local purchase. I was part of a USAID mission about 3 years ago to evaluate U.S. humanitarian aid in the Congo. And as you know, 70%, at least at that time, of the money spent by the World Food Program in the Congo came from the United States. What we found were two things which I think are particularly significant today given the high food prices. First of all, we were told that if cash were used for IDP emergency aid and continuing aid, it would be 1/15 the cost of what it cost the World Food Program to supply the IDP camps with the food because of the enormous cost of transportation. The second thing we found was that out of the four items that were being distributed, beans, salt, cornmeal, and vegetable oil, two were immediately locally sold, oil and cornmeal. And the money that was gained by local recipients for that was used to purchase manioc and palm oil.
Right.
Now, obviously, this is extremely inefficient and discourages local agriculture. Our report, which sort of pointed this out, was not well received because the people at AID argued this is not in our power to change because it is mandated by Congress. So I'd like to, in a way, push you a little bit further on that issue. Because with the very high food prices today and biofuels, do we need, from an American point of view, to continue putting these limitations on what the World Food Program can distribute? Can we not be infinitely more efficient by using the money instead of the corn, which isn't even used?
Thank you. I think that's enough to start out with.
Okay. First, let me thank the Friends of the World Food Program. Karen Sendelbeck, the president, is here somewhere. And Rick Leach and others, who the whole team does a fantastic job supporting us here with George McGovern and Senator Dole and others. We face some heartbreaking choices on where to cut. And we hope we don't get too far down this road. As I mentioned, most of what WFP does these days would be considered in the urgent emergency category. Also, over 90% of our work is earmarked, i.e., countries contribute to a particular crisis or problem, so I don't have a lot of flexibility to move things. But we will face, in the next couple of weeks, the need to cut at least 400,000 children from school feeding. We've been borrowing from our future pipeline in the hopes of increased contributions coming in, and we've had great help from the U.S. this week and elsewhere, but we're literally sitting down thinking, what goes now? But these are very, very challenging choices and not ones that we relish making at all. Brenda, you're absolutely right. This is all about nutrition, which is why I said we're now at the point, you know, in an era of when WFP was literally a surplus food program, we filled the cup with whatever we could get and it saved lives. But we now know, the world now knows, as important as what's in the cup and what is the content of the cup, and is it tailored to meet the specific nutritional needs? I mentioned the Lancet series that just came out. There's a couple of new studies that are so powerful. One by WFP demonstrates that if you don't invest in nutrition, it has a 6% hit, I think is the conclusion, on the GDP of countries. This is an issue that finance ministers should be paying attention to. And we now know how, in a very tailored way and inexpensive way, to deal with the basic nutritional needs. IFPRI,
has just come out with a study, the first ever, tracking two groups of people in Guatemala, those that had an intervention under two with adequate nutrition and those that didn't, same population group. And 20 or 30 years later, the only difference being this intervention, those that got adequate nutrition under two were making twice as much money as those who weren't. So it really affects productivity and economies. And my dream is that these issues become finance ministry issues, not just health department issues. At WFP, we have really made it, you know, part of our cause to try to link up with UNICEF and WHO to put in, we have some sprinkles we can put in for 2 cents into this cup that revolutionizes a child's life, and to also focus on the under two, which we know is particularly a critical time to do that. I use the words fairly interchangeably because a hungry person is not getting adequate nutrition, but it is important not to lose the important message on nutrition, and I thank you for underscoring it. On DRC, I'll give you another piece of good news. I just awarded a team at WFP that reopened 3,000 kilometers of road, north-south pipeline, east-west pipeline in DRC that had been closed for decades, so food can flow and farmers can get food out. This is what we do to get out of food desperation situations. And we did the same in Angola. I just awarded a team in Angola. Our team in Angola removed 3 generations of landmines, and one of them lost their lives doing this. But this reopens vital lifelines for food. So that kind of thing can help. Just on the cash, I have, this is my passion, is how can we use food aid to build food security? How can it be a productive investment? We can do it by, if we have commodities, using it to help people with training, food for assets, to build local schools and hospitals. It's a win-win situation. Local youth get employment, they get training, we rebuild societies. When we have cash, we have more flexibility. First of all, there is a cost savings, not always, and not as much as one might think, because we actually now have a body of work of studying this. Intra-African transportation, for example, can be far more expensive than overseas transportation bringing food in. Often local procurement, like in Senegal, from the 7,000 salt producers, is much more labor-intensive and cost-intensive than just buying from the big suppliers. But nevertheless, we feel the benefit is so huge that we are doing that. Plus, stability of supply is an issue. Now, Europe basically gives me cash now, and this has given us flexibility in our portfolio. Some places there is no food, and we need commodities. Today, I purchase more from Belgium than before when they were giving us commodity aid. And I just want to point this out because the global food aid system needs the major food producers. There's not enough food. I won't say we're tapped out in local markets, but there isn't a whole lot more room to purchase a whole lot more in most of these countries. It takes a lot of capacity building where we're working. And Ethiopia this year told us to stop buying locally because they don't have enough food, and we never want to compete with local populations in our local purchase. But there is opportunity here, in particular, as I said, if we do our contracting right, to help farmers break the cycle of poverty. And sometimes we can get a cost saving that's quite significant that can really help. What is most important to us is the flexibility. And again, half our portfolio is now cash. That helps us have the flexibility. And any, you know, additional flexibility would be great. But most importantly, I would just like to see, you know, American farmers helping with this very exciting project we have on how we can use the cash to help them break the cycle of poverty, and I think that would be a wonderful contribution.
I think we have time for one more round of questions. If you could just make them brief and concise.
Mark Stuckert with the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, agency of the U.S. government for development, and we don't give grants, but we make long-term, relatively low-cost loans. Thank you for your extraordinary remarks. Just today, New York Times, little girl picking through a garbage dump in Haiti looking for food. And I hope you find the money for those 400,000 school children, because I think that's been one of the extraordinary programs that you've put on, you and UNICEF. You mentioned access to credit. That's where we're strong at. We just did a board-approved project, a big agricultural project for Afghanistan yesterday. And we'd like to do more. We're very good at lending to banks that then can lend for agribusiness, small and medium-sized enterprises. So good luck.
Let's see, right here. Let me just pass the mic back. Stacey White from the Humanitarian Futures Program out of London. I just wondered, you've talked a lot about food aid to food security, and I wonder how donor cycles, either government or now private foundations, how those relief cycles actually affect your ability to make longer-term commitments to local farmers and logistics, and also your ability to compete for contracts.
One last question, right here, up here in the front.
I'm Rajul Pandya Loach, Chief of Staff at IFPRI, and I have a question for you. First of all, thank you very much for your very clear, very comprehensive, and a wonderful presentation. There is one set of factors. Very clear.
Thank you.
There is one set of factors you haven't talked about much, and I wondered if you wanted to say a few words, because WFP is unique among almost all of the agencies in the dealings that you have with the business community, the private sector, from local level to global level. And I wonder what role you see for those actors in resolving the problem that we have now. What opportunities, what would you want to tell them to get them engaged in solving the problem? Thank you.
Thank you. First, can I say this is such a great group, and it's so great to be among people who have written the book on much of this work, who have been there over the decades, who have seen the challenges and opportunity, have seen WFP grow and develop, and I really want to thank you. These are great questions, just great questions. First of all, I love OPIC. I was on your board until a couple of years ago when I was at State. Let me give two wish lists here. First of all, remittances. Remittances dwarf all foreign aid, and EFAD, which is one of our partners in Rome, the International Financing for Agricultural Development Agency, not a very well-known agency, but kind of a mini World Bank for agricultural investment. Great agency, has made it their business to look at how remittances could be captured as a productive investment into agriculture locally. So, for example, even if someone has been receiving remittances for 20 years, they can't go to a bank and claim they have a steady flow of income, typically. And so backing up those remittances, and I know that OPIC has looked a little bit at this. Luis Alberto Moreno, the president of the Inter-American Development Bank, has done great work on this. But this would be a fantastic source of credit for the 60%, 70% of the world's poor who are farmers. So remittances would be a great area. The other thing is backing up risk. So of all the revolutions in microcredit, less than, 4% goes to farmers. They're too risky. No one will, no one invests in the farmers. And actually, they have no backup to failure from weather. The World Food Program launched in Ethiopia the world's first weather insurance pilot, drought insurance pilot, which has proven a market success. And we worked with AXA Insurance in France, and we worked with Swiss Re to get a large enough pool of farmers that pooled their risk for drought. So if they were devastated, they'd be able to get back their livestock. And these are powerful ideas. We cannot go into an era of climate change without risk mitigation tools. And I think OPIC could play a big role, as you do, in kind of backing up some of the kind of risk in these areas. And we'd love to work with you, and the head of our Washington office, Mike Usnick, is here, and others. Haiti school children, I'll go on my soapbox here for a moment. Maybe you thought I've been on it for a while, but okay.
I really do believe that school feeding should be a universal phenomenon. And I would love for the world to be able to say, maybe we didn't end world hunger in our lifetime. I think this generation coming up is going to do it, by the way. But that we ended, no child goes to school hungry. This is a vision Senator George McGovern has. And I actually asked our people to price it out. So for the world to say, no kid goes to school hungry, which, by the way, WFP does a big portion of this, but many NGOs do school feeding, and governments. We've had 36 governments take over our programs, like Brazil, Morocco, Jordan, fully take over our programs. But it would cost $3 billion a year for the world to say no kid goes to school hungry. Now, before the prices started soaring, it was like $1.5 billion. I was like, wow. I mean, that's actually achievable. In a $40 trillion world economy, $3 billion a year, and the new generation can actually study and concentrate in school. So I have as one goal what I call my Fill the Cup campaign, and I've just taken it to the public because, 25 cents in this cup can change a kid's lifetime, and you do that for 1 year, it's $50 a year to do that. So I'm really, we have this on the internet, we're just asking people, help us fill the cup. I went on Oprah. I don't think, this is not typical for the World Food Program, but because individuals can make a difference here. And 93% of what they put in this cup gets to the kids. And so, this is a very powerful thing, and we've put out a global appeal to do so. What intrigues me, and I know these things get complicated, but if every student in the world who can well afford to put a quarter in the cup wouldn't even feel the difference, we would have ended hunger among school children in the world. And that quarter went to those who don't have it. So it's just intriguing because it's so doable. So I'm with you on the school feeding and the importance of it, and it hurts me terribly to look at the fact that we may have to roll back our school feeding, and you face a debate, do we cut the cup amount in half? Do we cut the number of kids? What do you do? So we're hoping that the world will step up and help us with our appeal. On donor cycles, I can't commit money to anything before I get the actual money from governments. And so we, Canada just gave us $125 million. That is a, I think, 5-year commitment to school feeding. And this allows us to tell the schools, we'll be with you for 5 years. This becomes, many of you do have an idea of how important this is, that kind of stability. I can rarely do that. And in the new farm bill, there's a provision, the McGovern-Dole provision, where we're asking for a definite commitment for school feeding. There's nothing, it really, truly, of all the work I do, there's nothing more heartbreaking than pulling, the cup of food away from kids that, it allows them to concentrate, to learn. And in Egypt, the labor ministry pays for it because it's such a powerful anti-child labor thing. Otherwise, kids have to go forage or figure out how to get food. It allows them to go to school. Let me tell you another most powerful human rights story I've ever heard for women. WFP, when it has the money, will give girls an extra ration at the end of the week for perfect attendance. And in many of the countries, less than 20% of the students in schools are girls. When we provide that ration, something happens, even in cultures where girls have never gone to school. Their fathers start ordering them to go to school. No, we don't have to debate anything. It's an economic incentive for very poor families, where it becomes part of the family's strength to have the girls go to school. And they stay in until they're 16. I'll tell you something else. If we give this extra ration, which costs less than 25 cents a day, to HIV/AIDS orphans, they're guaranteed a home. It works perfectly. You don't have to build an orphanage. The extended family will take them in. But typically, they're overwhelmed. But it's very, we're looking for the Paris Declaration on good donor principles is very key here, which is multi-year commitments. And it's, there's no area it's more key than, with food. So it also could help us. I'm a spot buyer in markets all over the world. I can't hedge in any way. I can't buy futures contracts. I mean, it becomes very difficult to manage these swings in markets without any type of this. So we have engaged our board in that dialogue and really urging that kind of support just so we can have a fairly steady picture or somewhat of a steady picture for the future.
Well, I'm afraid our time has come to an end, but Josette, we can't thank you enough for your comments today and your work on behalf of...